I guess the best word that I could use was numb. If you watch the video, my hands are in my pocket. I don't hug my parents. I'm withdrawn. I can remove myself enough to see that I look like a kid that had been kidnapped, abused for a year, without a doubt.
Hello and welcome to the Insights Podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is Jody Plochet, author, speaker, and survivor of one of the most widely publicized child abuse cases in the United States. As a boy, Jody was sexually abused by his karate instructor, a trusted family friend, who later kidnapped him and took him across state lines on a 2,000-mile journey to California. Days after Jody's rescue, his father, Gary Plochet, shot and killed the abuser in front of rolling TV cameras. In the years since, Jody has become a passionate advocate for child safety and abuse prevention. His book, Why Gary Why, not only tells Jody's story, it helps others to recognize the signs of grooming and abuse. Today's conversation will cover sensitive topics, obviously, and a link to a webpage with relevant support resources will be available in the show notes. It's a story of pain, but also of survival and hope. Jody Plochet, you're welcome to the Insights Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, Jody, can you describe your own childhood and what your family life was like when you were growing up?
I think growing up, our family life was like that of any, you know, typical family in America. I mean, we just were just a regular family, and we ended up taking karate. Well, before we were taking karate, I was playing football. I was playing softball or baseball, basketball, soccer. So I was involved in all kinds of sports. So, you know, my older brother was involved in sports. I was involved in sports. And so my parents were bringing us to practice. So we were just a family that was involved just in the community. And my parents decided when I was 10 years old to put me in karate. But the reason why they were putting me and my older brother in karate is because my little brother, so he wouldn't do it alone, they put me and my older brother in it because we were playing all these other sports.
And what kind of a place did you live? Was it a big city, small town? What exactly was the setting?
Baton Rouge, I would consider Baton Rouge kind of like a medium-sized city. Like, it's not New York City, it's not, you know, L.A., but Baton Rouge it's a college town. We have LSU and we have Southern University. So we have two universities. It's the state capital. So it's the capital of Louisiana. So Baton Rouge is a small, big town.
Yeah. And as a youngster, you described the sports you participated in. What kind of a kid were you aside from that? Were you shy or were you outgoing or a mixture of both maybe?
I was pretty much outgoing. I mean, it's funny because as a kid, I was outgoing. Now I'm still outgoing, but I also like to be alone.
And your parents, they were obviously very interested in helping you get involved in activities and so forth. So things were pretty good at home, would it be fair to assume?
As far as being a kid, it was, but, you know, my dad drank a lot. And so other than him drinking and coming home drunk, other than that, no, everything was good. And that's from my mother's opinion. So my dad's drinking did not affect me as a child because my mother hid all that.
But obviously it would have created tension between them.
Well, yeah, when the lights went out in the evening, that created the tension.
So you get introduced to karate in support of your kid brother, you and your older brother. Presumably that's how you first met Jeff Doucette.
Yes. All right. So the story behind that is we started taking karate. Our first lessons were at my little brother's school because he's the one that brought home the flyer. There was a guy named Rick, and Rick was our first karate instructor. So we went back to our second lesson, and he didn't show up. So the organization that we had paid the money to found a up-and-coming karate instructor who was willing to do free lessons for kids, and that's how we ended up with Jeff.
And he, it's the truth to say, fairly quickly, he integrated himself into your own family.
Looking back, extremely quickly. Soon after we started taking karate, we went to the movies one night to see this movie, They Call Me Bruce. And then after we went to Chuck E. Cheese, where my cousin was having a birthday party. So, I mean, almost like the first night we went out with him, he came and met my family, not just mom and dad, but my aunts and uncles and cousins. And so he kind of immediately just was welcomed into the family.
And at that stage, I mean, looking back now, I suppose, with the perspective of not just years, decades on, were there perhaps red flags early on that maybe might have been missed?
In 1982, 3, I don't think there was the education. I don't think there was the knowledge of the signs and symptoms to look for. There probably was, but they weren't talked about. But looking back now, absolutely. But back then, no. I mean, there were certain signs, like the fact that I quit playing all the other sports that I had played. So the personality change in me, I think, would be the number one thing to look for if you were a parent. But there were other things. The fact that Jeff wanted to spend more time with me than anybody else, that's a big sign. You know, if a 25-year-old man wants to hang out with an 11-year-old boy.
And at what stage did you begin to feel uncomfortable in relation to his unhealthy interest in you?
Immediately. The first time him testing my boundaries, and that's where they inappropriately touch you. But then if you go, Jeff, your hand's on my pee-pee, then he'll go, oh, it was an accident. And then that way they don't get in trouble. So he was testing my boundaries, and I was driving the car. He put me in his lap, and he was letting me drive the car, and he was doing the stick shift, and he was working the clutch, and he put his hands in my lap. And that's when it first registered to me that, like, okay, wait, this might not be right. But I kind of wrote it off, and I just let it go. Then it progressed from that. Then about a month later, we were in a road trip in Houston, and then there was an old John Wayne movie on. He turned that movie off, and then he went underneath the covers from May 1983 till February 1984. He would pretty much every day.
And how did you yourself, I mean, as a 10-year-old kid, rationalize or cope with what was happening?
All I knew is I had seen a made-for-TV special. My mother had made us watch that show, and she had explained to me that there were grown-ups that would do bad things to children, and if, you know, anyone ever did something like that to you, it wasn't your fault. And so I immediately recognized the fact that Jeff was the one that had something wrong with him. It wasn't me. And so I never blamed myself. So I got to give my mother credit for that.
You didn't make a connection between realizing or learning that it wasn't you who was at fault to actually speaking about it, reporting it.
Well, people ask me that all the time. They're like, why didn't you tell? And I'm like, because I knew my dad would kill him. And that's exactly what happened. But I pretty much kept a secret to protect my parents.
Why, had your father said something to the effect that if anybody harmed you or one of your siblings, he'd kill the person responsible?
I don't know if he actually said that quote, but he said things to that where I was to believe that he would. Not that I thought my father was a murderous person. I never thought my dad would do something like that. I mean, parents tell you all the time, you know, if you do this, I'll do that. But they don't. And my dad was always the opposite. My dad was like, the next time you do it, you're in trouble. But there was just something about my father where I knew, like, if he said it, he meant it.
Clearly, you were targeted and chosen and groomed by Jeff Doucette. You didn't feel you could talk to your parents. But what about other people in the karate class, including your brothers? You didn't tell them?
The only other person that knew about what was going on between me and Jeff was the other boy he had been molested, who had gotten too old.
When all of this was going on, what was your attitude towards Jeff? I mean, did you see him as a friend? Did you see him as somebody who cared about you or a mentor or something like that?
I saw him as a friend who cared about me. Like, I mean, I never thought Jeff was going to hurt me. So I was never scared or worried when he kidnapped me. I did realize that, okay, what he was doing was a crime and my parents were going to call the police. I knew both worlds.
Tell me about the day that you were kidnapped by Jeff Doucette.
Jeff came to the house and he asked my mother, can I borrow your car? One of the karate students, their parents were building a new house. And Jeff's brother owns a carpet business. And they were ordering carpet from Jeff's brother. And Jeff told my mother, I need to go check and see if the carpet's been delivered. Can Jody ride with me? And my mother was like, yeah. And she gave him the keys to her car, and he took her car and me to Port Arthur, Texas.
So did you have any idea at that stage what his plans were? Had he ever mentioned that he might take you on a road trip?
He had mentioned it probably 2 months prior. The day of, I did not know, but when we were in the car, we weren't driving towards the house that had the carpet. We were driving towards his brother's house, and that's when he's like, no, we're going to California.
Which was a fair distance away, thousands of miles, 2,000 miles. So how did you get to California? Did you drive all the way?
So we took my mother's car to Port Arthur, Texas, and then that was Sunday, February 19th, 1984. And then he spent that Monday trying to get money to get a bus ticket to L.A., and we didn't leave until that Tuesday. We went to his mother's house. So we stayed at his mother's house Sunday night and Monday night. And then we went to Orange, Texas, and we took a bus from Orange, Texas to L.A. Well, on a bus, I mean, he can't abuse me. So those 5 days were probably the best 5 days of the time I knew him.
And you presumably figured this was way out of the ordinary, but were you afraid? Were you scared?
To me, I looked at it like an exciting trip. You got to realize the abuse was not abnormal at this point. So I had been abused for a year. So anything outside of the abuse was an exciting trip.
So you went to California. Where did you stay when you got there?
When we got to California, we had no money. So Jeff had to figure out how to wait to get money. And so he bought a karate magazine and he called this guy from Houston because we had fought in a few of his tournaments. And Jeff, they weren't friends, but they, you know, were acquaintance. And so he said, look, you know, I took a group out to California. Our van got stolen. Can you wire me $600? I'll pay you back when I get home. And so he took that first night, he took that money. And this was not the best choice for someone on limited funds. But he got a room at the Hilton downtown L.A., which at the time was like $85. In comparison, the motel we were staying at when he got arrested in Anaheim was $6. So that's not the place you want to stay when you stay at limited funds. So we stayed at a high-end hotel the first night, and then the rest we stayed at low-end motels.
And did he have a plan? I mean, I gather the reason he wanted to get out of Baton Rouge is because he was on the run from some financial debts. Did he explain what he was going to do, or was it just a case of making it up as he went along?
Making it up as he went along. He had no plan.
So how were you eventually found, I mean, and tracked down by the police and leading to your rescue?
February 19th, I was kidnapped. 1 week later, he said, call your mother, let her know you're okay. And so I called her up and we paid for the phone call. So like it was a short phone call and we went to the motel desk and we paid for the call, like, you know, $6. And then we called again and I paid whatever. Well, eventually he literally was down to $6 and he had no money. So I think he let me call collect.
That call to your mom, what was the reaction when you got talking to her?
Well, the first night when I called her, she was just like, I could hear in her voice that she was just happy to be talking to me because for a week she didn't know where I was. But I kind of do feel like she didn't think that Jeff would hurt me, but she didn't want Jeff to have me.
But had she reported you or had your parents reported you to the police as missing?
Oh, no. So he took me Sunday morning. Jeff's mother called her and said, Jeff is going to be dropping Jody off tomorrow morning. Like, he'll be back tomorrow. So that was Monday. He didn't drop me off. So Tuesday, my mother and the police went to Port Arthur looking for me. She basically immediately called right away. He told me to call my mother, collect. And I think he knew, like, it was over. And I think he kind of voluntarily gave himself up. You could make a collect phone call. That's where you would call someone long distance. And you would make them pay for the phone call. So Jeff let me call my mother, collect. And she asked for time and charges. So what that basically meant was the operator would get on the phone. And so the operator would call the person you wanted to talk to and say, hey, do you want to collect call from Jody? And so my mother said, yes. Well, she asked for time and charges. That meant since she was paying for it, she had the right to know how long that call was and how much it cost after the phone call was over. And so once we hung up the phone, the operator came back to my mother, who was with Sheriff Deputy Mike Barnett. And he said, look, tell me where that phone call came from. I need to know exactly where it came from. And he was in touch with the FBI and he informed the FBI in Anaheim Police Department, and they raided the room. So that's how they found me, by the collect phone call.
How quickly after the phone call ended did they appear?
You know what? I would say within the hour.
How were you then reunited with your family? Were you flown home from California?
Yeah, I flew home from California. I left LAX about, well, I think it was 1:10 or 1:15 in the morning, and I was flown into New Orleans. A direct flight. When I got off the plane, there were TV cameras there, and I was kind of mad. If you watch the video, I looked like a child that had been abused for a year. My hair had been dyed black. My parents didn't recognize me.
And your emotional state, what was that like when you were reunited with your family, Jody?
I guess the best word that I could use was numb. If you watch the video, my hands are in my pocket. I don't hug my parents. I'm withdrawn. I can remove myself enough to see that I look like a kid that had been kidnapped, abused for a year, without a doubt.
Why were you annoyed? Was it the fact that there were cameras flashing and cameras rolling on your arrival back?
I'll tell you a funny thing is the news in LA had gotten wind that I had been kidnapped. I guess they read the police signals or they listen to it or whatever. And so the guy who drove me to the airport told me that they wanted to come, the news wanted to come film me on the plane. He was like, the news wanted to film your departure. And I was like, that's fine. So I was cool with them filming me leaving California, but I was equally as annoyed to have the camera there when I arrived. Because, I mean, think about this. Do you think today they would never show a kidnapped kid's plane ride home? They wouldn't even name the kid. He put the microphone in my face and he said, what do you think about this, all this? And I'm like, I don't know. They would never go to a kidnapped child. And they would, like I said, they wouldn't name them, let alone put a microphone in their face.
You were back and presumably the police asked you all sorts of questions, your parents as well, obviously, about what had happened. How forthcoming were you about the abuse that you'd been enduring once you got back from California?
I denied everything. I wasn't trying to protect Jeff. I was trying to protect me because in 1984, at that time, in 1984, child molesters weren't getting life in prison. It wasn't talked about. I credit my dad for a lot of sexual abuse reform or awareness.
What was your reaction then to the arrest of Jeff Doucette?
I wasn't really emotional about it. Like I said, I was numb. I was an abused child. I was just a shell of a person. But when Daddy shot Jeff, I actually was upset that Jeff had gotten killed. I didn't want Jeff dead. I would have liked for him to go to jail for the rest of his life. But, you know, I still considered him kind of like as a friend. I was mad at Daddy because at the time Daddy shot Jeff, no one knew I had been sexually abused. It took me a couple months to get over the fact that my dad did that because I was mad at him, but I got over it. And we, you know, I would say we had a great relationship for the rest of our life.
And how did you first learn that your father had shot Jeff Doucette?
It was a Friday, and my grandparents had picked us up and brought us to our, we had a little vacation home on a lake called False River, and they took us there. And for whatever reason, I guess the last 2 weeks had gotten to me. So I went to bed early that night. Normally, I used to watch the news. As a kid, I would watch the news and go to bed. And I went to bed early before the news. And so the next morning, we woke up and my grandparents were like, you know, pack your bags. Let's get together. We're going back to Baton Rouge. And we're like, why? We didn't know why. They took us out there one night and they're taking us back the next day, the next morning, actually. And so we were all like, and it's a chapter in my book. It's called Where's Daddy? And we're like, where's Daddy? Where's Daddy? And we're driving back. And I could tell my grandparents were concerned. But I was thinking my dad probably got arrested for like a DWI or something, or maybe got a car wreck. And so we get back to my grandparents' house. And my mother shows up in a cop car with my uncle, who was a sheriff deputy. And so I knew something was bad, but I didn't know what I was going to hear. And so she sat the four kids on the step at my grandparents' house. And she said, last night, Jeff was being returned home and Daddy shot Jeff. And at the time, he wasn't officially dead. They hadn't pronounced him dead. And so I think one of my siblings said, good. Another one started crying. My daddy's going to jail. And of course, I got upset because, you know, Daddy had shot Jeff. I didn't want people to know what had happened to me. But also, like I said, at the time, I didn't want Jeff dead.
And at that stage, when your father shot Jeff dead, had the police gathered evidence that, in fact, there had been abuse? And did your father know about it?
Yes, that was kind of like the deciding factor on whether my dad went to jail or not. When they arrested Jeff, they took me to the police station. They questioned me. Then they took me to the hospital and they did a sexual assault kit. And so they had taken that sample, did the FBI report. And so like 1 week before Daddy shot Jeff, Mike Barnett sat my parents down and let them know that the hospital report had came back positive. And so me and my mother had been talking for a week before the shooting, but she was telling my dad what I was telling her. And my dad obviously couldn't handle that.
So he found out where Jeff was going to be brought. Was it a tip-off from a TV station or something like that?
All right, yeah. So in college, my dad used to work for WBRZ, which is Channel 2 in Baton Rouge. He was on the bowling team. So he was friends with all the people that worked at that news station. And they were the news station that covered my return. And the reason they covered my return is because my dad was friends with them. He told him, he said, look, my son's coming back. So they covered the return. So they were doing a follow-up story. That's the reason why there's only one video footage. There's like five news stations that were there. It was just his friends. And so they were doing the follow-up, and that's how they caught the footage.
How did your dad manage to avoid jail? Was it because he had good lawyers or what happened? Because presumably he was charged and tried.
I would go back to the hospital report. The rape report where Mike Burnett told my parents that the hospital report came back positive for sexual abuse. I think that's how he got away with it. Because if he would have faced trial, no jury in Baton Rouge, Louisiana in 1984 would have convicted my father.
So did your father serve any time in jail?
He shot him on a Friday night. He posted bail on Monday and he went to a psychiatric facility for a couple of weeks and that was it.
So no time in jail. Do you think he should have done time?
No.
Ultimately, he got a suspended sentence and some community service.
I'll tell you what, I would have rather Jeff go to jail than, you know, my dad shoot him.
How did your relationship with your dad then, how did that evolve or develop after the shooting and after the court case?
All right, so a few months after the shooting, I was upset with my father because at the time, no one knew I'd been sexually abused. So once my dad shot Jeff, I had to go to school and face the fact that all my classmates now knew. So yeah, I was mad at him. But eventually, I forgave him. And probably, you know, that summer, things were back to normal. And I would say we had a normal relationship for a father who was a good father. Because I say that, specify a normal relationship with a father who's a good father, because I know there are a lot of bad fathers. I'm talking about a normal relationship with a father who's a good father.
Your healing process, did you get counseling or any therapy? How did you go about recovering?
They made me go to a psychologist or psychiatrist. I don't know which one it was, but it was probably like 6 months. And they told me I had to do this because of court. But after 6 months, the psychologist told my parents, so like, he don't need to come see me no more. He's going to be fine.
And where are you?
I think I am. I think it affected me. I think, you know, my mindset was from someone who was abused. So I think I had control issues, which is something that's very common in sexual abuse victims. They have control issues. They got OCD. They want everything clean. They wash their hands. I didn't know it at the time. But looking back.
And you wrote the book, as I mentioned earlier, Why Gary, Why? Was that part of your healing process?
At the time, I would say no. Looking back, because I started writing that book in 1993, it wasn't published till 2019. So I'm guessing that was part of my healing process. I mean, and actually, I'm glad I started writing it in 1993, because there were a lot of things when I started sort of trying to rewrite it in 2017 that I didn't remember. So I was like, I'm glad I wrote this.
The title, explain the title, Why Gary, Why?
My dad pulled the trigger, kills Jeff, and there were two police officers, Mike Burnett and Bud Connor. Bud was walking next to Jeff, and Mike had gone ahead of Bud and Jeff to look for daddy, to look for any parents or any person that might want to harm Jeff. And as soon as that video starts, you can see Mike looking kind of past the camera. There's the camera, and he's looking behind the camera because about 30 or 40 people had gathered behind the camera. And we're wondering what the camera was for. They wanted to see what, you know, what's going down. And Mike told me and Mike, we met up a couple weeks ago. He came walking out of corner and he's thinking, look at these people. They think some celebrity's coming. And he said, as soon as I thought that, that's when he heard the shot. He said, why, Gary, why? He wasn't asking Gary why he shot Jeff. He knew why he shot Jeff because he's the one who told daddy that the hospital report had came back positive. He led the investigation. And his question was, you have four kids and a wife. Why would you basically send yourself to jail for the rest of your life? Because he shot someone in front of the television camera. Mike wasn't thinking daddy was going to get off. He's like, I have to arrest you. I have to put you in jail. And Mike told me, he was like, people looked at me like I was the bad guy. People called me like, how can you arrest this man? He's like, I had no choice. He shot someone on camera.
In addition, Jody, to you telling your story, you offer in the book, you offer advice to parents about the red flags to watch out for. Do you want to take us through some of those? You mentioned the fact that you'd given up sport and just concentrated on the karate.
Yeah, the fact that I gave up all my sports, there was clearly a personality change because Jeff wanted me to sit with him and watch the TV shows when we were hanging out instead of me going out and playing with my cousins and the other kids. So there was a personality change. But the biggest red flag that I like to say is if someone wants to spend more time with your child than you do, that's a red flag.
What's interesting, and I suppose encouraging as well for people who would read your book, is that you say, you know, you hope to let victims know that if you've been through something like that, with the proper support, you can be okay.
100%. That is my message from day one. I'm not scarred for life. I'm not damaged goods. You know, I'd rather talk about cooking gumbo or crawfish etouffee than this. But you know what? That's what I'm known for, and I'll accept it. But yeah, no, you can go through something if you have the proper support, be it a psychologist, a friend, just as long as you got someone who can give you the proper support. Because I don't advise anyone to do what my father did. My father put himself in a position to be prosecuted with four kids and a wife, and he could have went to jail for the rest of his life. He got lucky. So I do not advise that. My advice is to be there for your child.
I suppose I have one last question for you. Is that if you could say one thing to your younger, maybe even your younger 10-year-old self, what would it be?
Something bad happened to you, but you know what? You have a long life to live. Don't let that ruin the rest of it. Enjoy the rest of everything that you have to live. Your dad's not going to jail, and you're going to write a hell of a book one day.
Well, look, Jody Plochet, thank you so much indeed for taking the time to talk to us. I know it's early morning over there where you are in Baton Rouge. So we appreciate your time. And just one final word to our listeners, that if you have been impacted by today's conversation, you will find a link to a webpage with relevant contact information that's in the show notes. And the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre is available at drcc.ie, or you can visit 1in4 at 1in4.ie. Thank you indeed. And thank you, Jody Plochet, for joining us.
Thank you.
That was episode 18 in this series. To hear more, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll find a whole range of episodes with our wonderful guests who share their insights, including neuroscientist Dr. Brian Penny discussing his 15-year addiction to heroin, an inspiring but also such a feel-good conversation. Disability campaigner and entrepreneur Sinead Burke on making it an accessible world for everyone and the conversation she's having at events for Vogue and the Met Gala. Plus many, many more. And remember, please follow the series to be alerted when new episodes become available.